My guest today is Joe McGinnis. 20 years ago, McGinnis made a name for himself with his behind-the-scenes account of the marketing of Richard Nixon, The Selling of the President, 1968, his expose of how television merchandises style over substance. His interest in layers of illusion and self-delusion extend to his accounts of notorious murders. Fatal Vision told of how a respectable former Green Beret, Jeffrey McDonald, murdered his wife and children. And McGinnis's new book, Blind Faith, is about the murder of Maria Marshall of Toms River, New Jersey. The apparently unlikely suspect who was eventually convicted was Maria's husband, Rob. The Marshalls led what appeared to be a life of affluence, knitted together by love. Along the way, we learn, though, that Rob Marshall was carrying on with another married woman, was over his head in Atlantic City dirty deals and deep in debt. His way of clarifying his life? To murder his wife to collect the insurance money. Joe McGinnis's book, Blind Faith, follows the community of Toms River, New Jersey, as the facts about the murder become known. I asked Joe McGinnis what it is about a murder story that appeals to him as a writer.
Murder is the most extreme example of an action that a human being can be driven to commit. In two instances, Blind Faith and previous to that, Fatal Vision, I've become interested in stories that involve murder, but really for very different reasons. And it's not been in my own career and my own history as a writer, it has not been a long-standing preoccupation. I'm interested in storytelling primarily, and it has happened almost by coincidence that the two stories in a row have turned out to involve murder, but it's not a particular preoccupation or obsession of mine.
How did you choose this particular murder of Toms River, the Marshall, Maria Marshall murder in New Jersey? What set you on the trail of writing about it?
Well, I began to get mail from Toms River back in, I suppose it was the fall of 1984. At the time that the Fatal Vision miniseries was on the air, a lot of people were watching that TV show and writing letters to me as the author of the book saying that, gosh, I had a brother-in-law who was murdered once and you should write a book about him. And I was getting literally hundreds of letters about murders coming in, month after month, and most of them I wouldn't even read from start to finish. I had no interest in doing another story about a murder, but this one letter from Toms River really caught my eye because, first of all, it was very well written. Secondly, it made a connection, not necessarily a cause and effect connection, but took this event, the murder of Maria Marshall, and tied it to a set of social values which had overtaken, and some would say had corrupted, that community over the preceding generation. And it has always interested me to explore, to get a sense of place, to write a book about a community and how a particular event can transform the lives of people who live in a community. I live in a small town myself. I'm interested in the relationships that these kinds of between various levels of the community. One other big factor here was that there were the three living sons, the three teenage sons of Maria Marshall, who were, in the weeks after her murder, apparently the only three people in Toms River who believed that their father was innocent. So immediately I saw the possibilities for an extraordinary story with a tension that would pit these three loyal sons against this community, which had immediately and instinctively had jumped to the conclusion that their father was guilty of the crime.
In the course of writing the book, did you make further use of the person who'd written you the letter about the murder?
I spent some time talking to that person, and in fact, in responding to the letter and then in talking to that person by telephone, introductions were arranged to various other people in the community so that several months later, I found my interest waxing rather than waning, and I decided to take a drive down there. In fact, I was in Philadelphia at the time and drove over to Toms River and spent just a couple days talking to some of the people that I'd been made aware of and feeling some kinds of vibrations in that town. And I began to just instinctively sense that there was something very important here. And at that point, I got in touch with the three sons and told them that I was thinking of writing a book about the town's reaction to the murder of their mother and what would transpire. At that point, their father had not yet been arrested, though he was widely suspected of having committed the crime, being involved in it. And they made it clear that they had no objection to my interest, and in fact would be willing to cooperate. And so I began to spend more time there, and in fact spent the entire summer of 1985 living right down there in that Toms River area with my family, and just, you know, pursued it from there.
Now, the character of the town comes through in the book as lending values, or actually the people of the town lend have this set of values, an affluent suburban lifestyle, and an extraordinary need to keep up appearances. You have somebody saying that if your till is less full 1 year than it was the year previous, people can sort of smell that out and begin to want to discard you as a fellow citizen.
That certainly seems true among the social set with which the Marshalls associated. Toms River, overall, is probably as much a blue-collar town as it is an affluent white-collar town. It's not mainline Philadelphia suburb. It's really people from less educated backgrounds, lower on the socioeconomic scale. But there is within that a subgroup of people who have tried to carve out for themselves a status that is denied to everyone else surrounding them. So you have the country club set, you have the fast crowd, you have the crowd that was attracted to the glitz and glitter of the Atlantic City gambling casinos when they came to town. And that became a very important theme to me. I've always been interested in exploring, going back to the Selling of the President, I think, exploring the difference between illusion and reality. And, you know, here was the illusion, the appearance that all was as the American dream would have it be, that this was the cleavers of Leave It to Beaver come to life, that these people really led the kinds of lives that you would see in the pages of Good Housekeeping magazine. But just beneath that surface, something very, very different was going on. And that turned out to be, in the case of the Marshall family, something not just different, but horrific.
And so you like using, in many ways, the way Truman Capote and Norman Mailer have, using murder as a window on a community and a way of life.
I think so. I think in this case, the Marshall murder opened a window on Toms River and a way of life there that many people felt was going to someday have inevitably tragic consequences. And I think the Toms River, while it has its own particular nature and definition and quality, is in many ways a metaphor for what's been going on in and across America, in big cities and in the suburbs throughout the 80s, where acquisitiveness has become a national value. One recent reviewer of the book pointed out that the title Blind Faith did not only refer to the boys' original blind faith in their father's innocence, but really to our tendency to put a mask on materialism and call it the American dream. And this is really a book about what happens when that mask is stripped away.
One of the keystones of blind faith is the three sons who maintain the faith in their father up until the very end, up until the moment of conviction. What was it that helped them maintain that belief in their father in the face of the entire community and evidence seemed to show that their father was the one who had killed their mother?
He was all they had left. You know, they had been very, very close to their mother. They were in vulnerable teenage years. They had these two parents who they thought loved them equally well and very, very much. Their mother was suddenly, viciously taken away from them in an instant. And their father was all they had left to cling to. It's like a shipwreck. They were suddenly out in the middle of this vast ocean, and their father was the only sort of lifeboat they could climb aboard, or the only timber they could cling to. To abandon faith in him would have been to have left themselves totally bereft of anyone or anything to believe in. And it was a terribly difficult process for them to go through, and the fact that two of the three have made that journey is something for which I give them enormous credit.
And one has not?
Well, the youngest to the best of my knowledge, the one who was 13 at the time still professes to believe that his father did not commit this crime.
Hmm. How did the two who eventually changed their mind cope with the public defoliation of their father's character and, of course, also with their own sense of family?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by defoliation. At the trial, it was very upsetting for them to see their father's personality crumble so publicly under cross-examination by the prosecutor, to see the story held up to be so transparently false.
But we all want our father to represent an ideal. We want our father to be an upstanding, correct man, a man who is somebody we can look up to. And bit by bit, two of the boys begin to realize that the father is not who they had seen him. And, you know, he almost strips himself of the illusion by the time each time he tells a lie that the sons recognize as a lie.
What was hardest for them, and what Robbie, the oldest, expressed to me quite eloquently, was that it made him wonder if everything that had come before had not also been a lie, that the whole 18 years that up until the murder he had thought of as being so happy were somehow not just, had not all been an illusion, that there was not just a tragic moment beyond which everything fell apart, but that all that had come before it had also been false. And not only his future and present, but his past were illusory. And in one's late teenage years, to have to come to terms with a concept like that is probably putting a considerable amount of psychological stress upon oneself. And I frankly find it quite remarkable the degree to which he and his brother Chris have coped with this.
Rob Marshall was sentenced to death by lethal injection. Is he still on death row?
He is on death row in New Jersey. There is, in any death sentence case, a mandatory appeal process. That process is underway. It's not yet completed. There have been no rulings. There's been nothing yet to set aside either the verdict or the sentence, but there's no effective date yet. I think there are 17 or 18 people on death row in New Jersey right now, but no one has yet been executed. The entire death penalty law in New Jersey is still under judicial review.
Has there been any communication between the boys and their father?
I understand that John still maintains contact with the father. The two older boys have had none whatsoever for, gosh, it must be a year and a half now, if not longer. If he writes to them, they tear the letters up unopened. They don't call, they don't visit. They've both said to me that whether or not he's ultimately put to death is almost irrelevant to them now, because as far as they're concerned, he's already dead. He's just not part of their lives anymore.
How do you organize one of these stories, particularly when the action is known? You say that's the part that least interests you. How do you then set forth a way to tell the story so that the reader is gripped by the action, by the characters involved? Is this something easy and straightforward for you?
Oh, Lord, no. I think if it were, first of all, the books wouldn't take as long to write. And
how long do they take?
Well, this one I began work on in, you know, serious work, I guess, in the spring of 85, and it's now very early 89, so we're talking almost 4 years. Now, I lost a little bit of time to litigation that resulted from the last book I published with Jeffrey McDonald, but basically this was it took 4 years to tell, because one of the differences between nonfiction and fiction is that in a nonfiction book, you can't make the characters do things that they don't do. You can't invent them in ways or cause them to behave in ways that are artistically satisfying to you if, in fact, that's not the way they're behaving. You sometimes have to just wait for them to catch up to you. In the case of these three Marshall boys, I couldn't rush their loss of faith. I had to sit back and wait to let nature take its course, which in the case of the two older boys, it did, as Robbie and Chris, in their own separate ways, came to the separate but identical conclusion that their father was guilty. As he was convicted in March of 1986, And I had a conversation with all three sons a month or so after that, in which they were all at that point saying that they still felt that they were going to be loyal to Dad, and you know, he couldn't have done it, and they were going to stand by him. And at that point, I knew that at least the two older sons didn't really mean that, but they still felt compelled to say it. So I had to wait a full year before they got back in touch with me and told me that they were now ready to open up and tell me what they really felt and what had been going on all along. You really can't control events as a nonfiction writer the way you can as a novelist. That's one of the limitations.
Well, Jeffrey McDonald had been the subject of Fatal Vision, the Green Beret, accused of killing his family and convicted of it. It ended up in this incredible legal turmoil. He, in fact, sued you for breach of contract. Insurance companies didn't support you, and it was, I think, probably a fairly unhappy time for you. What did you do in writing this current book to try to avoid any of those traps that caught you on Fatal Vision?
Well, in any book, first of all, what you do as a writer, not just to avoid legal traps, but just because it's what you're supposed to do in writing nonfiction, is be true to the facts. Make sure that you are telling the true story. You know, truth is a perfectly adequate defense against libel. You can't prevent someone from suing you, but you can prevent them from prevailing as long as what you write is accurate and does not invade the privacy of individuals. These are two separate statutes. In America today, in recent years, there's been a climate which has so favored plaintiffs in this type of litigation that I mean, the number of serious nonfiction writers who have been sued and whose books in some cases have been suppressed, people like Peter Matheson, J. Anthony Lucas, Janet Malcolm, Shana Alexander, I mean, the list of nonfiction writers who have been sued by disgruntled subjects is almost endless and growing every day. In Blind Faith, I wanted to minimize the risk of that kind of unnecessary harassment. I might add Joseph Wamba to that list. Joe Wamba has told me that he never again intends to write a nonfiction book set in America simply because he's so tired of the harassing litigation that invariably ensues. For characters whose identities are not central to the story, you simply change the names. I'd much rather tell the true story with a pseudonym than have to withhold from the reader important facts in order to not aggravate a subject who might be displeased by the way they're portrayed.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to Fatal Vision, a book that you began writing, and you spent time with Jeffrey McDonald, the man accused of the murder of his family, and you started out with a presumption of innocence on his part, and as you worked on the book, you found that you were believing that he was guilty. And I'm wondering how that changed your sense of how to cover the case, as it were, as your own perceptions changed. And also in looking back on him, what it felt to be working in such close proximity day after day with a man who became convicted of these horrid crimes.
Well, it got to be, I mean, I approached that case with really an open mind. I mean, technically with the presumption of innocence as a juror would have going into a courtroom, but I basically went into it not knowing any of the facts and having no idea whether he was guilty or not guilty. I spent the 7 weeks of his trial living in a fraternity house with him and his lawyers and family and friends, and actually grew to like the man very much. Talk about con. He is somebody who has a remarkable ability, as do many psychopaths, to charm and con. There's a cunning, there's a very forceful personality there. And I found myself really hoping that it would turn out that the facts would not support the accusations against him. But day after day after day in court, I saw these facts mounting, and it got to be a pretty spooky and chilling thing to realize that I was perhaps in the presence of somebody who had committed those dreadful crimes, but at the same time, who on a personal level, I had not yet begun to develop distaste for. It was only when I distanced myself from him and sat down with the facts and let the facts emerge clearly, and I kind of moved out beyond the orbit of his personal magnetism, that I was able to put that book together in the way that I did.
And he also seems to have been captivated by your charm, and then ultimately felt misled. He felt that he was going to get a book that would exonerate him.
Well, he certainly assumed that anybody who ever would write about him would believe his version of events. He believed that the jury was going to acquit him. He believed that that any newspaper reporter who ever interviewed him would accept his story at face value. That's another part of what I would tend to think is his pathology. That's the psychopathic personality is one where truth and falsity really have no meaning, where event or action and feeling are totally divorced from one another, and therefore it's easy to become unrealistically optimistic.
What was your experience with Fatal Vision, the TV show? I notice also you've have somebody already working on the script for Blind Faith. Were you pleased with the production of Fatal Vision on TV?
I was very pleased with the way that that production remained faithful to the facts as presented in the book. They made a decision that it would be impossible to explore the dark inner recesses of Jeffrey McDonald's mind, which is really what my book tried to do. But in staying on the surface of the story, they remained rigorously true to the facts as I had presented them in the book, and that's why I was so eager to see the same people involved in the Blind Faith production. The same screenwriter, John Gay, who did Fatal Vision, is working on the screenplay for Blind Faith, which will be an NBC miniseries the same way Fatal Vision was. So I'm so far one of the few writers, I think, who would say that he's very happy with the way television has respected his work and has treated him.
I want to jump topics just for a bit. Later this week, George Bush will be inaugurated as president. And you chronicled the selling of the president, 1968, the television campaigns, the advertising that was used to help elect Richard Nixon as president. And at the time, one of the media advisors was Roger Ailes, who helped out with the George Bush campaign, and in fact made some of the more controversial ads of the campaign. Did you have a sense of deja vu in watching the campaign of 1988?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was, I had a sense of watching Roger, who I had seen as a promising rookie in 1968, really at the top of his form, batting 400, so to speak, with this 1988 campaign. It was interesting. I wrote an introduction to the new edition of The Selling of the President that was published by Penguin this past fall. And in doing so, I talked to Roger, this was back in January, just about a year ago, to try to get up to date on some things. And Roger at that time was telling me that both George Bush and Bob Dole had approached him and had asked him to do their campaigns, to head the whole advertising effort. And he recognized that the choice that he would make between them essentially would be choosing who would be the next president of the United States. And he said he gave it very careful thought and talked to them both a great deal and wound up choosing Bush because he felt that Bush was simply a better man and also would be easier to work with. And then seeing the campaign unfold, it was a textbook approach. Roger had said in January, "I hope they nominate Dukakis. I think they will. There's nobody easier to do commercials against than the governor of a small state who nobody outside that state has ever heard of, because we can create the first impression of him. The nation does not yet have one." And that's exactly what he did with this Pledge of Allegiance business and the Willie Horton commercials. And it was really a sense of watching a process which was so intriguing to me 20 years ago in its germinating stages bloom into full flower as it did here.
So politics, in a sense, has always been a con game. You said that in The Selling of the President. Any hope for the country? Do you think that will change in any way, or is that just the way things are?
Well, I don't know that we're going to transform ourselves overnight. I mean, people are able to recognize, despite the essential con nature of the game, where the politician is trying to sell himself to us. You know, we don't know who these people are. Our only perception of them comes through electronic media, and largely it is today television which shapes our perception of national candidates. On the political scale, what we see through in presidential campaigns, and on a smaller scale, the very same principles is what lawyers try to do in a courtroom. You know, to take it back to blind faith. You know, we have Rob Marshall here is on trial for his life, His lawyer stands up and has to argue to the jury that that this man didn't do what he's accused of doing, to try to make the jury like the client so that they won't want to find him guilty and sentence him to death. I mean, there's a the con game goes on, you know, all day, every day, in all forms of commerce. It's not confined to politics.
Sure, I mean, and that's the upshot of Fatal Vision, a man who tries to present himself as a style in a certain way. The same with the Marshall, with Rob Marshall, who tries to present himself as an upstanding member of the community with this sort of facade. But when you look behind it, just as you would go behind a television set and see the candidate, it's clearly something quite different.
It's like the Wizard of Oz, you know. When you finally get behind, you know, what do you see? You know, you just see this this little man doing all this manipulating. That's why I'm drawn in stories like this to the people who are not interested in conning. You know, when I can find there's not a whole lot of innocence left in the world, at least not in the worlds that I explore, but when I find it, whether it's in people living in Alaska or whether in this case it's in these three teenage Marshall sons, people who are not interested in con, who are interested only in being themselves and in trying to let the world see who they really are, I find that so refreshing, and find myself drawn to write about that.